You don't write children's books. You write books that children sometimes read and adults read. I never thought of myself really as a children's book writer.
Norton Juster, author of one of the most beloved children's books, The Phantom Tollbooth. That's coming up on In Contrast. I'm Ilan Stavans, and In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio. My guest today is Norton Juster, author of Phantom Tollbooth and The Dot and the Line. It is a pleasure, Norton, to have you here with us. Let me start by asking you, how did the Phantom Tollbooth come to be? How did you conceive of it, the moment you started writing it?
All those things happened, but they happened in complete chaos, I think. And I had come to Amherst, a series of steps. We lived, and I was brought up in New York. I was married in New York. We were living there. I got into architecture. My father was an architect. My brother was an architect. And I loved to assemble any old junk, really, that I found in the house or anywhere. I had an uncle who lived in Long Island working with one of those companies that built inexpensive houses. And every Friday, without fail, he would come to my house in Brooklyn with a box full of ends of cuts and pieces of wood. And we'd spend the whole day building whatever it was. The first we'd build it, then we'd name it. And so I loved the whole idea of making things, and especially out of things that were random. You didn't know what they were for, and you just made things that way. With my father being an architect, and with my brother studying architecture, and with me loving to make things, it was just a very natural thing to have happen. I went to the University of Pennsylvania, came out, went to England for a year and a half on a Fulbright, came back for a while, worked for a while, and then decided I wasn't quite sure whether that was for me or not. You know, you do things, and then you suddenly reach a point in your life where you say, can I do that? Am I good enough for it? Do I have the commitment to do it? That was the beginning of my writing career. I decided that I was going to try architecture, but in the meantime, I was going to explore some other areas. And at that time, the Ford Foundation was advertising in the papers where they wanted to give out a fellowship for someone to write a book on any subject that they wanted. It seemed ridiculous to me, but I said, oh, I'll give that a try. I applied, never expecting to get anything, and I was given the award, which is a reasonably good amount of money, something like about $7,000 a year, which was at that point in time quite substantial. I got the award on the basis of doing a book basically for children on urban planning and urban life, how people lived in cities, how they moved around, how they made a living, how it affected them.
Was this something that, as part of the intention, you wanted to educate children about how to live in a city or how to...
Well, part of it was that, not so much how to live in it, but how living in it could be changed and affect their lives, how they could improve their lives, other people's lives. And it seemed very pertinent at the moment, because this was happening now right after World War II, and my Fulbright was to study cities being made, especially the ones that had been destroyed, in England, in Great Britain. This sounded like something that would be a wonderful thing to include in the curriculum of an elementary school.
And did you have the vision of the entire book when you sat down and began writing it, or did it emerge? And how did the character come to be?
Well, I didn't know at all what I really wanted to do in specific terms. So I sort of launched myself without having any idea which way I was going or why even. But I started collecting a lot of materials. And suddenly I hit a panic button. What are you doing? You don't have enough background, enough experience in building and planning to do this kind of a book. I did panic. I accepted all this money to do the book. If I don't do it, they're going to arrest me and put me away for years. And then I took a vacation. I said, okay, I've got to get away from it all. And I had some friends who had a beach house out in Fire Island on Long Island in New York. I went out and stayed with them for several weeks. Did nothing but walk up and down the beach. And in order to avoid thinking about the book on cities, I started to think about other things in no apparent order or with no reason. What it resulted in was me thinking about my growing up, what I was like as a child, what direction I really wanted to go in, and what was life like for me at that time.
Is the protagonist of the book really you, the way you were? Rambunctious, thinking in terms of the riddles in wordplay, in putting logic in question?
Very much. I was a very peculiar kind of a child. When I was growing up, I always had the feeling that nothing I said anybody understood, and nothing that they said did I understand. This includes adults, teachers, my own parents. I always had a different viewpoint, if you could even call it a viewpoint, on all the things that happened and that I got involved in. I was sure about one thing. I thought, and I was pretty sure of it, that adults didn't have the capacity to tell you the truth. And they didn't have a capacity to understand anything I was talking about. And it was very strange for me because I didn't know how to deal with it. In my early years, I was very introverted. Everything sort of went in and stewed around and came out in a very personal way, just oddball things I would think about.
Were you a passionate reader when you were a child?
Yes, very much so, and all different kinds of things. My parents, who were both from Europe, had shelves full of Russian and Yiddish novels, which were in translation, of course, some of them being up to about 1,500 words, the kind of task I would never have taken on to read such things, but I started. Understood very little, but loved them because they were full of language that I had never heard before. And I was thinking, is that the way you really communicate with people?
So, and did you think when reading them that you would want one day to write one of those?
I was never really ambitious to write in that way. And I didn't know what I was going to do, but I also knew, and it was beginning to fill me with things to think about, that there are words, ways of expressing yourself, all kinds of things that I now were thinking about that I had never thought about before. I used to read poetry, because a lot of times you were assigned it in school, and I didn't know what I was reading. And after a while, it didn't matter because I was enjoying the fact that these were words used very differently than I understood, some of them almost like music. I began to be very interested, and I began to read poetry. I still do today, and it's the same thing. I don't understand a lot of what I'm reading, but it's less the understanding than the music.
And who were your favorite authors, writers, when you were little? Were they also authors of children's books, or were you reading all these novels that you're talking about in the family library that were more for adults?
Well, there were other things in the family library, but the answer to your question, first of all, is yes. I was still reading a great deal. I went with a little branch library a few blocks from our house in a very dingy two-floor building.
This is in Brooklyn?
In Brooklyn, in Flatbush. I would go there all the time. They would constantly be throwing me out of the adult section. But I loved reading the books. And I started reading grown-up novels, again, with the same problems, but they slowly began to, you know, to come into shape. And the other thing, which you may probably cut out of this, I was what must have been about maybe 10, 11, 12, or in that range. I would get constantly thrown out of the library for going over to the adult section and looking up dirty words in the dictionary, which I had very little other source for. But I loved coming to the library, and I loved being with books.
And the wordplay was part of the family dynamic with your father or with your mother, or you had an older brother as well.
It wasn't my mother who had talents in other directions. It wasn't so much my brother who was very intense in other areas. I mean, he was a marvelous athlete in anything that would take him out on a ball field or a basketball court or whatever he was there. But my father was, I considered, a very funny man, but he wasn't funny in a big ha-ha kind of way. He was funny on little things that he would say that maybe half an hour later you'd realize that he'd been talking nonsense. I'll give you an example, and this is something I've used before, but it's really true. I would walk into the house maybe at 3 o'clock around when I got back from school. He'd be sitting reading the paper in the living room, and he'd look up and he'd say, "Ah, I see you're coming early since lately. You used to be behind before, but now you're first at last." I had no idea what he was talking about, and he would sense that immediately. He'd get up, he'd walk over, pat me on the shoulder and then on the head, and say, "Well, you're a good kid, and I'd like to see you get ahead. You need one." Like any kid, I just wasn't quick enough or tutored enough, really, in words, but I knew that something wonderful was happening because he was saying things to me that I had no reply to.
How would you describe, Norton, that kind of playfulness? Was this looking at words not as they usually are, but from a different perspective, being...
Always, and that's been the story, you know, of my life, really, that I started doing that all over. When you're young, you have one response to a pun, and that is, because you don't know what someone's doing to you. After a while, I began realizing, you know, I understand some of these, and I can do some of them. And that would make you feel very powerful.
So do you think that puns play an important role in your intellectual development?
Oh, very much so, because it was not just me enjoying the jokes. It was me enjoying life a lot more, because a lot of the people who were punning or playing word games and things were people, you know, whether they were relatives or friends or teachers. It began to put a feeling in you that you could express yourself in so many different ways. And sometimes you leave people with no answer whatsoever. And sometimes you would feel very good of putting something over on them.
So going back to that scene that you were describing to me of being in Fire Island and beginning to think of how to solve this challenge that you had, having received money from a foundation to write a book for children, but not really knowing how to go about it, the sequence of the Phantom Tollbooth suddenly materialize in your head? Did you start writing? What happened?
It wasn't organized, and it wasn't sequential. It's interesting. I don't think in any book I've written, I've written it in a purely sequential way. But I started to think about things and remember things that I had not understood or misunderstood as a kid, and I began to realize I was gaining, really, a lot more command of what one does with language. At that point, I couldn't do it all, but I was moving in that direction. And I would take long walks on the beach. I always carry a little pad with me and make notes about things that would just pop into my mind and put them away. And I had these big 10 by 12 envelopes and, like, stuffed them up. And after a while, I had closets full of these things. But really what I was doing was remembering about myself as a kid and almost doing a historic outline, really, of what I was at that time. Not trying to write about myself, but to say, okay, now what do you do with all this? Or why is that interesting or what? So when I got home from the few weeks I spent out there, I had a lot of material. I didn't know where it was going, but I had a lot of material, and I was beginning to enjoy it. That's the big thing. I liked writing. I never considered the fact that I would ever be a writer. If someone had told me at that time in my life, well, in about 40 or 50 years, you're going to be living in a small rural town in Western Massachusetts and writing books primarily for children, I would have said they were insane. It never occurred to me as a thing to do. But when I got back from that trip to Fire Island, you know, I laid the book on cities aside, took this out, and started to work. And characters would conjure up. I needed a major character. Well, a boy like myself. That started me writing more things about myself or experiences I've had or disappointments or offenses, all of those things. My major concern was I was sure the Ford Foundation was going to send a couple of police cars over to my house, pick me up, and throw me in prison for 20 years.
This wasn't what they were hoping to get in your mind.
Oh, the funny thing was that at the end of this whole epic, a friend of mine contacted them. They were well aware of what had happened. The book had come out and been very successful. They were very happy, and they were not in the slight bit either offended or angry at me.
They were satisfied.
They loved what came out of it, and which made me feel very good. But the rest of the story of the book is also that kind of colored.
So how did the lack of sequence, these different snapshots that you were conjuring, came to have a coherence? Yeah. How did you put them together, this jigsaw puzzle?
I was one of the world's champion digressors. I'd start off in the morning sometimes with the sheets of notes, and I'd find a little piece that I could write into some dialogue. I love the idea of characters. I knew I couldn't invent cold characters without having some relationship, you know, with them. So when I wanted a character for the book, I would think about the character in a lot of ways, as a person, as someone who I might have known at that time, all different things. And I would start having conversations with them in my mind, and again, writing little notes down, because it seemed to me that you couldn't possibly invent a character and use it in a book if you didn't know that character, and if you didn't know how he thought, what he would do, or she, what she wouldn't do. These things began coming together. Well, firstly, there was Milo, of course, who was me. I discovered the name Milo when I was in University of Liverpool, because I had a lot of friends who were in the Dublin Theatre. And University of Liverpool is right across the little bay that goes between Ireland and England. I met a lot of theatre people, because Dublin, of course, is a great center of theatre. And I used to go over there, and they were very nice, and we had wonderful things, and they always got me much more drunk than I should have been. I would come in on Friday. Sunday night, they'd put me on the same ferry that goes across the bay, unconscious practically. And so that sort of ferry ride and the sea also, which was very rough, was very much a part of it because it shook everything up, and it got me going. But I met one young actor named Milo O'Shea from Dublin, and I got to know him. I didn't see him a tremendous amount of time, but I could say we were friends. And then he came over several years later and went out to Hollywood, and for many years was a very good character actor in films. And the name just fascinated me. I loved the name Milo. I never spoke to him after that. I was always too self-conscious.
One of the beautiful aspects of the Phantom Tollbooth is the collaboration with Jules Pfeiffer,
right,
who is also from Brooklyn. How did the two of you decide to work on this project? Did he show you some of the images? Did you deliver the entire manuscript to him before?
By the time I got to know him well enough, he was already well established as a cartoonist and artist. Extraordinarily talented. He's been described, I can't remember who said this, but it was quite correct. He was the only illustrator or cartoonist around who could illustrate an idea. I met him completely in an odd way. My last station in the Navy was at the Brooklyn Navy Yard. I discovered what they did in the Navy was to put you in a place where when you were released from service, you were close to home. When I was stationed there, they said, well, you can live on the base at Brooklyn Navy Yard, or we give you an allowance and you can live anywhere you want, which was a no-brainer for me because who wants to live on a Navy base? The amount of money they gave me, I'll never forget this because it's such an odd figure, was $77.10 a month. I walked over to Brooklyn Heights, which is a very nice section, and I found a woman who owned two houses on Hicks Street, and she was an Austrian dentist. Very nice woman. She ran the two houses. I took a room in the basement. Didn't even have a bath. It had across the hall was a bath, but it had a big backyard that was nice you could sit in. And somehow she took a tremendous liking to me. She would bring things over. I'd be sitting in there, and there'd be a knock on the door that leads out to the garden. She'd be there with a tray full of goodies or something like that. She was also a very close friend of Isaac Bashevis Singer, and he would come over there quite often, and she would make dinner for him and invite me. I didn't know Isaac Bashevis Singer. I learned a little bit about him. In fact, I never liked him. He was pretty much of a disagreeable character. And she would do things on a Sunday morning or something. She'd tiptoe across the garden with more things for me to eat, more goodies. And so it was a very nice relationship, And when I got started working, that atmosphere, have a nice quiet room in the basement, looks out on a garden where virtually nobody ever went except she and me, and just having that to myself. It was a perfect environment because there was almost nothing to distract you unless you wanted to be.
And did Jules Pfeiffer become a neighbor of yours?
He was living at the time on the second floor in another room. We met each other being in the house. He claims we met each other while putting the garbage out one day. He was very funny and very intelligent, and the drawings he made were terrific. I remember just before I got married, a series of wonderful sketches of myself and Jean, my wife. We've been married about 53, 54 years now. I played some terrible jokes on him, and he would get back at me. And of course, I think you have other things to talk about.
Did you give him the entire manuscript?
I left my stuff around in piles. He would take the pages I would have written or scribbled on or made notes on, and he would do the same thing visual terms. And they were quite wonderful. There was never an issue who was going to illustrate.
Did the fact that he was drawing them as you were writing them affect the way you ended up conceiving of the plot and conceiving of the story itself?
Well, I think he was absolutely brilliant in the idea of the way he embodied those figures. I don't think I ever edited or told him about that. He just took them away and how they felt to him, and they felt perfect to me. So I was very lucky.
When one writes for adults, one is talking to an audience as an adult in the same age range. But when one writes for children, it's a different challenge.
I reflect on that a lot. There's a funny story. Oh, about 6 months ago or so, I got a call from an old friend, a woman named Suzanne Collins. She wrote a number of books, those dystopian novels that were made into movies and things. And we chatted for a while, and she said she got an award from the Authors Guild. And she said they called her and asked her to name three people that she would like on the program who knew her well. And she said, "You're my first choice." So I said, "Fine, I'd love to do that." So I went, and subject of what I was going to say primarily should be how and why I write children's books. And I said to myself, "You don't write children's books. You write books that children sometimes read and adults read." I never thought of myself really as a children's book writer. I know that children read the books, but if you go anyplace like I do for signings, they're always filled with children, high school students, college students, adults, grandparents. That pleases me. It angers me, in fact, when you are forced by a publisher, or they try to force you, because I just wouldn't do it, to name the age group that the book is for. I don't believe in that one little bit. All during this time I was making these statements and trying to get into it a little bit, there was a lot of murmuring and disbelief going on around the auditorium we were in. But I really do believe that.
Do you think that children understand books differently?
They understand them differently. They understand in some areas less, but they're always plugged in to them. And I just like the way they receive some of my books. When my first book came out, I couldn't find a half a dozen people who would tell you that, "Gee, this is a children's book and it's really nice." Nobody believed it was a children's book.
When you finished the Phantom Tollbooth.
The manuscript, yeah. And they were getting ready to print it up, said, "We're going to send these out to see some people who are experienced in this kind of thing, teachers, librarians, anybody in with books, you know." And they sent copies to all of them. They all came back the same way. "This is not a children's book. Your vocabulary is so difficult, they will never tolerate it or read it. The story is far beyond their understanding." It went on and on and on and on. And finally, the whole thing was that you shouldn't be publishing this book.
Is the lesson here that publishers have no idea what they're doing?
I think that's the case. The way this came about was very slowly, in the sense that in the late 50s, everybody was very upset because American school children were doing very poorly on a certain kind of testing, math, science, things like that. And all the kids in Europe were burning up the world, you know, these things. So they said, they were wondering, what could they do? What could they do? "We've got to make our kids read better, faster." How do you do that? You make the reading easier. You know, it's really crazy when you start thinking about it. And that's what they tried to do. And my book was completely out of the ballpark, really, in terms of what they were trying to put together. They had word lists. If your book had some words in it that were not on these lists, forget it. I never really focused on that because I thought it's such a screwy idea. Why would anybody use it? And I was trying to also play with the language in the book, too. And
what is your recommendation today for someone who is dreaming of writing for children?
I know a lot of people who are writing children's books, and some of them are very good. I mean, I don't claim my way of doing it is the only way, but it's the only way that makes sense for me, because I don't think I could sit down and say, "You are going to write a book which teaches the following lessons," or, you know, "which makes people look at the world in this way." There's a little of that in the book, you know, that happens, but they're not done for that reason or anything. It's not that I wouldn't do it. I don't think I could. It would be very much too difficult for me to do that and achieve anything that would be acceptable, either to me or to anybody else.
One of the elements that I adore in the Phantom Tollbooth is the fact that Milo is on a journey. And the type of children's literature that I was attracted to, and still today, is the one about journeys. I'm thinking
always,
of The Wizard of Oz, and I'm thinking of Alice in Wonderland, and I'm thinking of The Little Prince.
Right.
And, of course, of yours, too. And I wonder if you can say something about those books, the books that have a character that is on a quest to find out something about the world, but obviously in the end, it's a quest to find out something about herself or himself.
Yeah. I agree with you. I love the idea of going somewhere. My favorite author, of course, was L. Frank Baum, when he wrote all the Oz books, and they were all taking a trip somewhere. But I agree with you completely that I think a quest where you find out things not only about where you are, but who you are and why those things, you know, happen to you. In the same way that I think about characters, one other thing that bothers me very much in children's books, the sense that, number one, they have a very limited capacity for understanding almost anything. And number two, that you can invent them as you want them. I have pages and pages and pages of conversations between myself and the characters, or between several of the characters that I'm just eavesdropping on, because quite often I'll end up writing 50 of these kinds of things, and some of them work and some of them don't. There are so many times where a character is called upon to make a decision or something, and you know this character, you know what he does, you know the decisions he makes, you know his ethics, you know his thought. He's in a position now where he's about to make a decision, or it's called on by the rest of the text, that has no relevance to what that character, the way you set him up before, would do. He could, instead of being a sweet, lovable character who would support someone or help them, he could be a terrible son of a bitch who just doesn't give a damn about anybody and would make decisions that would go against all you've done in the book so far. That's hard work when you do that, you know, because you've got to throw a ton out, which I've...
And the characters can surprise you.
Oh, yes.
Norton, like your father and like your brother, became an architect. So I wonder if you can talk about the relationship between your literature and architecture.
That was a thing that came on me as I started really writing. All of a sudden, I discovered that I absolutely think visually. All the architectural training, all the drawings I did for myself, for my just recreation, or while I was working on something else, or while I was working on the architectural project itself, were things I had to visualize, and I had to visualize not just how they looked, I had to visualize how they were used, how they felt, what they looked like, what colors they were. So useful to me, because it constantly brought my attention to these are real things, these are real people. These are not characters, you know, you should put them in a play or something. You had to know about them, and you had to see them, and you had to feel them, and you have to understand that maybe they may be inconsistent sometimes or what. All of these things went through my head, and they were a very important part. And if I couldn't visualize a character, say, which included if I was having a conversation or making up a conversation, which included myself and the character, I had to see how that character would gesture, what he was wearing, how he'd respond. Well, little things that were you didn't understand by words, but you understand by seeing the character. A lot of the questions that come to me, how do you write and why do you write? Is it hard? Is it easy? Blah, 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 blah. Writing is one of the most arduous and unpleasant things that you can possibly do in your life, because a lot of things you don't know. I can spend a whole day writing, and at the end of the day, go through it and go and throw it all away. It doesn't have the spirit. It doesn't have the all the things that you want someone to feel when they read the book. It doesn't have the honesty either. Well, anyway, so I start to tell people, and I say, well, there are three things. One of them is your anticipation of writing. That's one. Step one, the best part of writing anything. Because you can just fantasize about it. I'm going to write a book. It's going to be wonderful. It's going to make a lot of money. People are going to love it. I launch myself into it. The third thing is having finished writing. That's a very pleasant experience because you know you're done. And the worst part and the most difficult part, of course, is the second one, which is writing. That way you can wake up in the morning and say, oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to write anything today. I don't know where I want to go. I don't know what I want to do. I'll try a little bit. You're subject to all of these things. So at a certain point in your life, then, when you've anticipated, written, finished, you're going to be going through all of these things which are torturing yourself, because there are all the doubts, all the things that you're not sure of, you know, happening. Sometimes you think about it as just a very unpleasant, lengthy experience. At a certain point in your life, maybe 3 months later, maybe 6 months later, maybe otherwise, I look back at all of this and I realize that that whole period of time was one of the most enjoyable, one of the ways that you've accomplished most and produced what you set out to do on your own. You know, you didn't give up, even if you were having terrible troubles with it. You went through it, you did it, and you're pleased and proud of yourself that you had finished. Not that a book was going to be a great success, but that was the job, to start it and to finish it.
Now, when you submitted the book to the publisher, You talked already about all these puzzlements, all this idea that the publisher wasn't sure what type of audience, and that there were reactions from educators and other writers about this book is not for children. Did you work closely with an editor at the publishing house, and did that editor want to change elements in the book? Or did the book arrive in the same way that we readers today see it?
There's always an editor. I happen to be very lucky because I did The Phantom Tollbooth without an editor until the whole thing was almost all set up and done. Then we had an editor, but it was someone we were pretty much on equal terms. There are very good editors, ordinary editors, terrible editors. I like working with editors, but I will not do one thing. And a lot of editors do this. This is what you have to change. This is the way you have to change it. This is what it has to do. I go home and I look at it and I don't see it, you know, that way. So I'll come back and I'll say, look, I can't do it the way you want it, but I thought about it a lot and I've done a different thing. I still have some of what was in it original, still recognizes some of the things you're concerned about, but is done as part of my continuity of the book. It works if you get a guy who'll do that. The original editor we got, Jules had a friend, and when I had written about 50 pages, she said, I know an editor at Random House. Let me show him this. I love it. She goes to a guy who was one of the leading literary editors in American publishing, a guy named Jason Epstein. And Jason was one of the wonderful editors that I had. When we had conversations, they were all interconnected. I mean, there were two people talking to each other, not saying, this is what you must do, this is what you have to cut out. It's a very good question, though, because in my whole publishing career, I think there are two or three editors I've ever had that I said, God, that's a perfect editor.
I take it from everything you've told me that we are lucky to have the Phantom Tollbooth, in part not only because of the astonishing talent and vision that the book itself presents, but because they did not pigeonhole the book for children alone or for adults alone. And the fact that it went out into the world and it found its audience spontaneously is a happy occurrence. So I want to ask you, the book was published in 1961. Do you think that different generations read it differently? Are there interpretations that they tell you that surprise you? Do you think those interpretations change? Tell me about the relationship that you have had with your audience to wrap this wonderful conversation we've been having.
They often find things in it that for the life of me, I don't remember putting in. They get stimulated or excited or see something that gives them a start. And they're not things that I can say I consciously tried to do. They just, as I was going, that they seemed, you know, right to do. Can I tell you a story? This is a little bit off base, but I think it'll show you. One of the things that's always irritated me about teaching, especially in American elementary schools, is that they don't teach much. They put out a lot of information or words or dates or whatever you want to call it. And then what you have to do is remember those and parrot them back. Kids don't really take to this very much. And when we have a session with kids, and I've appeared at a lot of schools, I can always tell when a kid is going to ask a question by the first couple of words he says what it's going to be like. Because in many cases, the teacher will give him, it's supposed to be his question. He will talk and he'd finish. And then you see the eyes change. They're just dull or closed or whatever, because it's not his question. He doesn't care about that. It's a question that he's making points with on the teacher. He just has a blank expression to the effect saying, okay, I've done my job. Now let someone else ask a question. And that always annoyed me, because when I talk about kids and their questions, the reverse happens sometimes. They ask something very unique or very special or something I hadn't thought about or something that just is unexpected. And I'm so pleased by it. There's one example of things like that. I had been talking about how kids have problems or don't understand what teaching is, why people do it, why kids are there. There's always the question that comes up with kids, but I'm not going to use that. You know, so they think it's a whole area of the world that they don't have to know anything about. And I finished talking, and one of the kids in the class, he must have been about 10, 11 years old, started talking about, well, you're saying all these things about learning and everything, but what is it? And why do we have to do it? And he went into a long, rambling thing about what is education, why you have to be exposed to it, you know, how you use it, everything going on. And I was quite sober there because I said, how the hell am I going to answer that right now? So I said, okay, let me take it another way. I said, forget about the questions and the teaching. Suppose you're just here, you're standing somewhere, and you don't know, you're not thinking about anything. And suddenly you think about two or three things, a fact, a date, something that you have come across in your life that is stuck in your mind. I said, and then you think of it as being somehow floats up into the air and just is there all over the place, these little bits and pieces, and they're there. And I said, then after a while, you look again at all these things hanging in the air, and you see that this one has aligned to that one, and this one has aligned to that one. And I embroidered it in a certain way. And he's just thinking about all these things. And I know it's making, if not impact, it's giving him a few doubts and things, so which is what I want to do. And I finish it, and I said, and this is really the sum of what you do in your life to make yourself who you are. And he stopped and thought about it for a minute, and then he said, then what happens? Floored me, absolutely, because I was trying to sum up a direction that everybody's life takes, you know, and how wonderful it is that that's the way you learn and lead your life. So I don't know why I said it, and I regret it to this day, but I looked at him and said, and then you die. The kid was baffled, you know, he was really disturbed. So I went right back into it and tried to explain the whole thing, you know, the other way. But it's true, it was a learning moment for me, you know.
And then what happens? I love that sentence. It has been enlightening, Norton, to see how you put this book together. It is a book that is loved by millions of people, generation after generation, and all of us who have read it have been impacted by it. I appreciate very much you coming to the show.
Oh, thank you. It's been a pleasure. I love talking about that, the book and me, because I've learned more than anybody else reading the book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The best writers of children's books often say that children are a tough audience. A child doesn't waste time coming up with excuses. A child doesn't have theories on how a character should be built or what makes a good plot. A child is a tough audience because that child either likes something or not. Explaining why is irrelevant. Children also have their own logic. Or put it differently, they are illogically logical. A rabbit who is obsessed with time, a carpet that flies, a little prince that travels from one planet to another. In their world, things don't follow the laws of nature. Things happen because it's fun. For all these reasons, understanding what makes a children's book successful is like trying to understand alchemy. It makes no sense. Yet there is something in those books that speaks truly, honestly, and authentically to children and adults alike. Get yourself into the mind of a children's author and you'll find yourself in fascinating territory. The effort is made to go beyond the narrowness of adulthood. We all were children once, but how do you recover the elusive quality of that magical thinking? Successful children's books are so because they speak not only to children, but to the buried child in all of us. They make us nostalgic for a time when the laws of cause and effect do not apply. Children's books are tough to write because as we become adults, we deprive the world of its enchantments. Cheers to those who, through their pen, recreate that illogical logic. Next time on In Contrast.
I would include in the term memory how a memory comes into being, how it is an experiential process, how we are shaped by memory, how we shape memory according to our needs, our ideals, our religions, our politics. And so I would stress just the dynamic nature of memory.
James Young, How Tragedy is Remembered, next time on In Contrast. The executive producer of In Contrast is John Vosey. Our music is by the Fresh Cut Orchestra. I'm Ilan Stavans. Thank you for listening. In Contrast is a production of New England Public Radio.